Jason Solomons here with another edition of Film Weekly. This week, with knife, fork and sick bag at the ready, we meet author Eric Schlosser and director Robert Kenner to discuss their documentary, Food Inc., an Oscar-nominated murky story of what we really eat. And we meet dashing young British actor Jamie Campbell-Bauer to discuss his role in the Dutch film Winter in Wartime. Zan Brooks joins me to review Colin Firth in The Single Man, Benicio del Toro as The Wolfman, and Japanese genius Hayao Miyazaki is back with his latest animation, Ponyo. Yes, it's more nourishing than a Big Mac and fries. It's Film Weekly. This week sees the UK release of an Oscar-nominated film that will most definitely make you wince at your mince and chuck away the popcorn and fizzy pop as the final credits roll. Food Inc. is a documentary that traces the murky, corrupt politics and negative health impact of mass-produced foods, exploding the myth of the packaging in our supermarkets.
The way we eat has changed more in the last 50 years than in the previous 10,000. But the image that's used to sell the food, it is still the imagery of agrarian America. You go into the supermarket and you see pictures of farmers. The picket fence and the silo and the 30s farmhouse and the green grass.
I met up with both Eric and Robert this week in London, and I started out by asking Eric if he believed that the film's recent Oscar nomination was actually a vote of support by the Academy for the issues at the heart of their film.
Well, we hope so. Not just that, I'm not belittling Robbie's craft at all, but I think this is a very important issue, and I think that his film isn't just about food, it's really about corruption and unchecked corporate power in the United States. So if the Academy wants to bring attention to that, I'm delighted.
Yeah, I think there's been a move in recent years to bring attention to that, be it through feature films, be it through documentary. I noticed that Participant, one of your producers, or the idea behind it, that's Jeff Skoll, right?
Who's
been behind films like Syriana and George Clooney's movies in the past. So what was the sort of impetus for the project?
Well, I was inspired by Eric's book, Fast Food Nation, and that sort of opened up a whole new world to me. And it went beyond fast food. Again, it was about how this whole system of food production has become industrialized and the effect of this industrialization on the earth, on the animals, in the on the workers, and ultimately on the consumer's health.
Yeah. It's interesting. We're just about to have a coffee, and I even felt bad about, like, I suddenly think, where's this coffee? We had a documentary here in the UK a couple of years ago, award-winning one called Black Coffee, or Black Gold, it was called. It was about the production of coffee. Watching your film and watching and reading your book and watching the Richard Linklater film based on your movie, I haven't eaten guilt-free since. I'm sort of worried about everything that I put in my mouth. Is there a sense, though, Robert, when you do make a film like this, that you could be accused of scaring people so much that they are slightly frozen with what they can eat? They sort of mistrust everything.
Well, I think it's really important to not be frozen. I think it's you have to realize you're not going to be perfect. God knows I am not a perfect eater after having gone through this whole experience. You just have to start to, you know, what we wanted to do was to make people conscious, to make people think about the implications of what they're eating and what it really costs. So that you're going to, if you can improve two of your meals a day, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't walk around feeling guilty. You know, there's so many things we can feel guilty about. I don't think that's a productive way of dealing with the world.
Right. And as Eric says, it's not just about the health implications of what you are, what you eat, and losing weight and diabetes, which your film does touch on, but it is about the what you're supporting when you eat certain foods, what the chain, I suppose, the system that you're supporting.
Well, the film really looks at the ways in which they are marketing food that's creating terrible health problems for the consumers. The way they produce the food is awful for poor immigrant workers. And when it comes to meat, these industrial operations are like a science fiction dystopia in how they treat animals. I mean, we've been eating meat for thousands of years, and we've never been raising livestock in these strange industrial factories that are incredibly cruel. And then when you look at pesticide use and GMOs and their potential impact on the environment, this system is a disaster. And it's not that these corporate executives are terrible people deliberately trying to poison us. It's that the profit motive has gotten way out of hand, and there is no strong regulation. And when you get that amount of power, I mean, in the film, we look at Monsanto, which controls over 90% through its patents of the soya crop in the United States, and 60 or 70% of the maize crop. These are two of our, you know, major commodities. That amount of power is corrupting, and that's a very old wisdom that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and we need to break up some of these big companies. And in terms of how you, one of us, you know, each of us can make a difference, just direct our spending as much as we can in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that I think, you know, we have to understand is that we all love cheap food. You know, we're all drawn to it. It's fantastic. We spend less of our paycheck on this food than we ever have in the history of time. And we're, you know, we like it. The problem is it's coming to us at a very high unseen cost. And I think as we start to see the consequences of these costs, that we'll start to reconsider this cheap food. Because, you know, people say, isn't it elitist to think, you know, poor people can eat good food? Mm. The problem is we're subsidizing bad food that we're giving to poor people that's making them sick, and they're spending lots of money on medicine, or they're becoming non-functional. So I think this, you know, the way we've set this system up, it's elitist that we're creating a system that's making people sick.
When you watch your documentary, you do use quite a few American companies that UK audiences might not be familiar with. McDonald's obviously has the global brand, but you talk about some companies that I wasn't aware of, the chicken manufacturer Tyson, a couple of other ones.
Smithfield, Tyson, Monsanto.
Yeah, all of those. We don't know those.
Well, first of all, even in the States, when you go into a supermarket, things are not marked Tyson chicken necessarily. Sometimes they are. But they're also marked with, like, Farmer John, Farmer this. Things are disguised, you know, the illusion that it comes from a small farm with a white picket fence.
My Country Life butter does not come from a small maid churning away.
Yeah. Basically, there are few companies that control the food all over the world, and they're all consolidating, you know, more frequently, so that we're getting fewer and fewer companies. And this is not about boundaries and not about geography. This film's not about the United States. It's about a worldwide food system.
I always think these things are slightly, you know, like Matt Damon in the Informant, Steven Soderbergh movie. Right. That was about high fructose corn syrup as well, which I always thought was a kind of a strange thing. Then I saw your film and realized how important high fructose corn syrup was to the central tenets of our society. Have you been threatened? Have you had the shady kind of, you know, corporate world on your tail, Robert?
Well, we were, you know, it's, I never realized what a litigious world the world of food was. You know, I thought doing an expose on how our food is grown, how it gets to our table would be sort of an innocent enough topic, but it turned out to be a rather intimidating mm-hmm. one. There are laws like the veggie libel laws that make it
don't slander a cucumber.
Basically, that these food products have more rights than we do as individuals. It's actually rather similar to some English libel laws. So I better be careful here. But ultimately, we spent a fortune. I spent more money on legal fees on this film than the past 15 times three. And that's just legal fees. The fact is we had to go through everything with such a fine-tooth comb and had to keep redoing and redoing animation to make sure that we would be safe. So it was rather, you know, sort of a frightening experience. Mm-hmm. And there was no injunction against the film. There were attack websites that were put out. But what happened was all of a sudden this played into an exploding food, interest in food and a movement that's taking place in the States. And there was a tremendous amount of coverage. And then all of a sudden, we became a very successful documentary, one of the 20 most successful documentaries of all time. So these food companies that at first were, you know, sort of ignoring us and then sort of making fun of us, all of a sudden found themselves in a position where they would have to say, yes, we would like to discuss this. So all these companies that refused to take part were now sort of saying, this is such an important subject. So it took a food movement to bring forward this topic, and hopefully that will happen here to some.
I hope
Robbie doesn't know is they probably do have his credit report for the last 20 years, and that car parked across the street from his house, you know, doesn't belong to the neighbor.
And I do hope that the catering on Oscar night is sustainably sourced and good, because that would be wrong to have, you know, inappropriate catering at your Oscar do.
Yeah, I'm told actually you don't get to eat for quite a while, so perhaps by the time we do get to eat, you will eat anything. I have
a big thanks to Eric Schlosser and Robert Kenner there. They had their premiere here in the UK, fronted by Stella McCartney, of course, earlier this week. Food Inc. is served up here from Friday, the 12th of February. I'm now joined by genetically modified film critic Zan Brooks. Zan, we're going to be reviewing this week Wolfman, depilatory products thrown in. We'll look at Colin Firth in A Single Man, and we're going to look at the master of Japanese animation, Hayao Miyazaki's Ponyo. But Zan, let's start with Colin Firth in A Single Man.
What are you afraid of, sir?
Cars.
How can you live in Los Angeles and be afraid of cars?
Maybe you can't.
Sometimes my fear of things can almost paralyze me. It's like I get really panic-stricken and feel like I might explode or something. May I ask you a personal question, sir?
If you like.
Do you ever get high?
How old do I look to you?
Well, have you ever taken drugs?
Of course, Kenny.
Like what?
I don't feel I should be discussing this with you on campus, Mr. Potter.
It's the only way I get by sometimes. Have you ever tried mescaline?
Not my drug of choice. Shaved off one of my eyebrows once on mescaline, not a good look for me.
Colin Firth as the literary professor in Los Angeles, coming to terms with the death of his lover, who's played by Matthew Good, but we heard Kenny there, played by Nicholas Holt. Lots of Brits collected for Tom Ford's directorial debut. Is it as stylish as one would expect of Tom Ford?
Oh, it's stylized to the hilt and art directed to the nth degree, as you'd expect from the creative director of Gucci turned head of the Tom Ford fashion label.
He is. You've researched your fashion.
I really have, yeah. Well, I know my Tom. Can't you see? I'm wearing some Tom Ford now.
Absolutely. Your underwear, I take it.
Socks.
I think that people were a bit sniffy about Tom Ford coming out when I was at Venice when this film premiered, and it was like, oh, God, that Tom Ford film, it could be a disaster. I don't think it's a disaster at all.
Not at all. And you can understand why people might be sniffy, because this is, to all intents and purposes, a vanity project. He's bought and paid for it. It's all his own money. He got the rights to the Christopher Isherwood novel that it's based on. He basically plucked the cast from his bulging contacts book. Julianne Moore is a personal friend. He shares an agent with Colin Firth. So all of this is obviously going to stick in the craw of the struggling filmmaker who's trying to raise, you know, 50 grand to make a low-budget indie movie. And yet it is good. It is stylish, but there is a substance there to it as well.
Isn't it about style? I've really not a problem when film, which I think is a visual medium, does ally itself to fashion, which is also a visual medium, and photography is a visual medium. I was reminded of Bruce Weber's study of Chet Baker on Let's Get Lost at certain times. And again, that's about fashion and style coming together. They do say something. Clothes do make a man, and it's certainly in this film they make Colin Firth, and his character is about that kind of style and the kind of coldness that's reflected in the stuff that he has around him and the stuff, the starchy shirts that he wears.
I think you might be right. I think that may be what this film is about. But he also uses the Colin Firth persona very well. I've always found Firth to be quite a cold, stiff, unforthcoming actor. And yet here, because he's surrounded by this languid, swooning ambience, he kind of serves to keep it honest. He anchors it. I think that it's probably Firth's best performance. Certainly, it's the best fit of a Colin Firth performance in a film.
In it, he plays a literary professor in a university in Los Angeles. The Cuban Missile Crisis is bubbling up in the background. He loses his lover, Matthew Good, in a car crash. There's no spoiler, that's right in the first frame of it. And then contemplates suicide throughout. His life is kind of then peppered by colourful exploits. Meeting Julianne Moore, who's an old friend, and they kind of get drunk and have a kind of fag hat conversation. station. Then he meets a young boy in Nicholas Holt. And the director, Tom Ford, kind of puts splashes of colour as if they were sort of hot flushes, doesn't he? He kind of introduces colour to the palette a lot.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, another possible reference for this is Hockney's sort of LA paintings of the swimming pools and things like that. There's a whiff of Visconti, kind of European art house cinema to this. And obviously, critics are calling this Death in Venice Beach.
Exactly.
But it wears all these references quite lightly, I think. I didn't feel that this was weighed down by self-consciousness. It is, in some ways, a self-conscious film, but it has a fluidity to it as well.
That was sort of graceful and exquisite in a way. I think the film's been, Colin Firth, I'm pleased, has been nominated. He's one of those actors that we like a lot, but he's never really been in anything worth nominating.
Yes, it's true.
I thought the film's been a bit overlooked itself, and I think that's the sniffiness. It's like, well, we'll let Colin Firth in, but no, nothing for anyone else. But I do think the direction, the art direction on it, certainly, and the clothes have been absolutely fantastic.
And it is, I think, genuinely moving.
It's a
film about surfaces and lifestyle. And the slight disconnection of somebody who doesn't really fit into the society. Within that, it is poignant and moving and utterly believable.
Tom Ford is anxious to sort of say, well, because I'm fashion, this film isn't about fashion, it's not about being gay. Whilst I think it's a great film, I do actually disagree. I think it's very much about fashion. I think it's very much about the pain of being gay in the 1960s.
Absolutely, yeah.
and that's where the exquisite kind of pain of the film is. Did you cry?
I don't think I cried, but I very rarely cry in movies, and I always cry in the most cheesy, crass movies. This was a little too tasteful to make me cry.
Do you want a Roland Emmerich movie to really get you?
I really do.
Willing up.
The kid rescuing his dog from the burning building. Yeah, that'll get exactly. me.
Well, there's some nice dogs in this one. I did cry in this one because I cry unrequited love and things like that, and very infinitesimal kind of breaking points. And this one got me, I have to say. So well done.
Ford would be pleased to hear that. I think
so. But he'd be wearing very dark Tom Ford sunglasses, so you wouldn't see the tears.
Well, you'd see like a little glisten on his cheek that perfectly catches the light.
That's Tom Ford's A Single Man starring Colin Firth. Zan, let's move on to Howl at the Moon as Benicio del Toro comes out of the fatigues and the jungle in his Che cap to become a werewolf howling at the moon because he fancies Emily Blunt so much.
What's happened?
You have to leave. Please pack your things.
Did I do something?
It's not safe here. You must return to London tonight. I'll be out of here waiting.
Lawrence, wait. What are you afraid of?
If anything ever happened to you, I'd never forgive myself.
Hammer House of Horror, Victorian Gothic and Hairy Backs, and it's all there in The Wolfman.
It really is, and we've seen all this before, and by God, this gives it to us all over again. I think that probably one of the problems of this film is that this has become such a trope of horror, hasn't it? The Victorian pile, the dark moors, the gypsy encampment, that it almost is like, you almost know it more from sort of a Two Ronnies sketch than from an actual film. And that maybe keeps you at a slight arm's length. It means that you can never really sink into this.
What was the point of it? I thought it was the point when I saw the posters. Oh, brilliant, they're going to sort of camp it up at least. But they don't. I think everyone here, apart from Anthony Hopkins, is taking it quite seriously. I don't know what he's doing. He's just speaking very slowly.
He's speaking very slowly.
He's doing a Rob Brydon impression of himself.
He is, and yet the accent does wander a bit, doesn't it?
God.
It's like a sort of roams like a stray dog, I think, all over the district.
And he talks very, he says, lycanthropy. What are you doing? I'm going to spoil this film because there's the brilliant bit where he just turns into a silver hairy werewolf.
He does, yeah.
It's Anthony Hopkins. What are you doing? I sort of was quite enjoyed because I quite enjoyed the Victorian London thing, almost like I quite enjoyed it in Sherlock Holmes, the actual sort of the complete reimagining of Victorian London.
Or the Hughes Brothers From Hell, which had the same sort of digitally recreated London. It's almost like going into the London dungeon, isn't it?
Exactly, and you expect a little waxwork. But the acting was about, Benicio del Toro is supposed to play a sort of Shakespearean actor on the Victorian stage, and there's a little clip of him going, alas, por Yorick, I knew him, Horatio. It's just, it doesn't work.
It really doesn't work. Although, of course, Benicio del Toro is entirely believable as the Wolfman, and I think Rick Baker, who did the makeup, said that he didn't really have to do that much, that del Toro is kind of halfway there.
Rick Baker doesn't have to do much because this is what Rick Baker does. He's done he's done the werewolves in Werewolf in London. He did it in the Thriller video. And this is just a when he said sort of doing a sort of Michael Jackson tribute. Yeah. I was a bit upset that he didn't kind of, you know, actually break into song. It's close to midnight.
Maybe that's one of the DVD extras.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
There seems to be a lot, actually, that has been cut from this film. I mean, this film has famously had a very troubled production.
Yeah, what happened? Because Joe Johnston directed it.
Joe Johnston, but Mark Romanek was originally down to direct.
Did 1 hour photo.
Yeah, and then left because of that old Kenner creative differences. And it's been rumoured that certain portions of it were kind of directed with nobody actually in the director's chair, which is a sort of mystery as dark and as mysterious as the mystery of the Lincolnthropocy itself.
Maybe Benicio del Toro did the editing himself, because there's a lot of slashing.
I think he possibly did that while in wolf mode, really, because, yeah, there's a lot of gnawed bits to
the
this
claw.
Film.
There's also a bit where he sort of becomes Che Guevara again and goes mincing off in the woods. Well,
maybe he was
days.
Shooting it kind of while he was working on Che as well. There's a hidden history to this film that is far more interesting than the film itself.
And yet, I quite like gothic horror, Hammer House-y things and things getting on fire. I mean, like, all the cliches were great. All the hobbledehoy English kind of straw dogsy people that they managed
yeah,
to get.
Yeah, and Geraldine Chaplin as a wise old gypsy woman. I agree, there's something oddly reassuring and comforting and soothing about this dark, bloody, gothic fairy tale.
It's not so crap it's good.
No.
But it is crap.
It is crap. You put that on the poster.
Exactly. Well done, Benicio. I like Benicio. I like Emily. I like Anthony Hopkins.
Emily's got nothing to do in this,
unbelievable. Anyway, that's the Wolfman for you. We're going to move on to Ponyo, our third film for review this week. It is the genius of Studio Ghibli. I suppose the antidote to Pixar, and yet, strangely, in production with Pixar here. This is John Lasseter working with Hayao Miyazaki, the man who gave us Spirited Away and The Cat Returns and all sorts of other Japanese things. Howl's Moving Castle. There you go. We're going to hear a clip, not in the subtitled version, because they always release two together. This is the English version. This is the English language version, where the young boy, voiced by Noah Cyrus, who is the younger brother of Miley Cyrus, finds Ponyo, who's a fish, don't forget, who wants to be a human, in a jar, and sets her free.
That was weird. Looks kind of dead.
It licked me! It's alive!
Sasuke, we'll be late!
Mom, a goldfish!
So Ponyo is a fish, right?
Yes, Ponyo is a fish.
Right.
But then she becomes a little girl.
Right, that's weird.
It's unnatural, I think. It's ungodly.
It's against nature. I think this is one of the weirdest cartoons I've ever seen, in a really good way.
I think you might be right. I personally prefer Spirited Away, which I think is an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah.
This is more minor key, but in its way, it's just as strange and just as odd and just as concerned with what Miyazaki tends to be concerned with, which is basically childhood loneliness, I guess, and the quest for friendship and that sort of the rites of passage that comes with that. And, of course, with nature as well and the relationship of civilization to nature. This is very evocatively set in this little coastal community that's permanently lashed by storms and waves that kind of go over the road.
It reminded me of the place that's in the documentary, The Cove, where they do the dolphin
story. It is like that, yeah.
But maybe, because there's quite a lot of eco bits. There's a trawler that kind of brings up all the mud and the stuff from the floor.
Yeah.
And then there are these waves that are like, that are sort of like whales, aren't they? And they kind of come up and they grab people from the door. It's rather scary, isn't it?
It's scary in its very gentle, watercoloured kind of way. I have to say, I actually took my 5-year-old daughter to see this film, and she was bored out of her brain.
Really?
I
do wonder who it's for, because it is, I think, you know, anime is, it's kind of grown up, or at least teenager, isn't it? Because there's Liam Neeson stars in this, in a kind of Rula Lenska wig, big red hair, walking
yeah,
around.
Yeah, the king of the sea.
But it also, because he's coming back from the sea to get his daughter, it sort of reminds me of that film Taken, when he goes over to Paris to rescue
and
his
shoots
daughter.
All the Arabs.
Yeah, exactly. I can't even expect him to kind of attack all the... And strangely, in the Miyazaki world, it's sort of Japanese, but not. I mean, no one really looks that Japanese.
No, it's true. It's true. It's another curious thing that he does. And also, you know, the single parent aspect that's very subtly threaded in there. He's a beautiful, humane filmmaker. I don't think this is one of his best, but it's certainly strange and rich.
Now, and they're very strange. I mean, I didn't quite know what was going on at some point, where the old people's home, which is voiced by Cloris Leachman, some really kind of redoubtable old birds in there. And I didn't always get, they were under threat from the water. There's a tsunami going on. And there's a line that one woman says, that a fish with a face like a human always mean a tsunami's on the way. That's a really weird thing to say.
Look, these old people, they start losing their marbles. They'll say anything.
They will.
They're just trying to strike up a conversation.
I quite enjoyed it, but
enjoyed
it was bonkers. I'm interested that your five-year-old didn't.
Yeah, and my five-year-old really likes Spirited Away, but this
wow.
I felt was
is it the Marxist reading of it that
very
that
much
gives?
So. She's written several theses on it already. This maybe doesn't have quite the same punch and quite the same sweep and spectacle, but it does have that wonderful meld of the humdrum and the everyday with the fantastical and the mythic that
was
Miyazaki
it,
does
was it
so
nice
well.
To see hand-drawn animation after? Well, I know we saw The Princess and the Frog not that long ago, so it was this kind of return to the hand-drawn, and this is
yeah,
actually
and particularly
John
the Studio Ghibli style of hand-drawn animation, which I think is better than the classic Disney hand-drawn animation, although obviously the Disney thing has gone through various guises and permutations. But I think Miyazaki's animation has a real warmth to it and playfulness.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Ponyo, which we would go and see, but a five-year-old would not.
No.
So don't take your five-year-old. Go
she
and
ran out.
Yourself. Where did she go?
Into the lobby.
All right, okay. Just keep an eye on her next time, Zan. Zan Brooks, lovely to see you as ever. For more of Zan's reviews and the best film news in the world, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Never has young British acting talent been in such global demand, from Nicholas Holt in the aforementioned A Single Man to Robert Pattinson in the Twilight films. And so when I sat down to watch a Dutch-Belgian war film called Winter in Wartime, I wasn't surprised to see another of our young talents pop up. Jamie Campbell-Bauer has starred opposite Johnny Depp in Sweeney Todd and is just putting the finishing touches to Harry Potter. But in Winter in Wartime, he takes on the character of a British airman, Jack, caught behind enemy lines and in need of help.
Do you know how far it is to Zwolle from here?
Yes, it's first over the river, and then 530 kilometers to Zwolle. It was very dangerous to go over. I can help you.
I don't trust anybody. Keep your mouth shut, do you understand? If the Germans find me, they'll kill you. If you talk, I'll break your legs. Have you got it?
And then I come back. I flout this.
Is there any chance of getting some more food? Not much left, you see.
Yeah.
Michiel, I'm Jack.
A scene there from Winter in Wartime, and joining me in the studio to tell me more about making the film is Jamie Campbell-Bauer, or should I say, Jack the Airman.
Ah. Oh. Stop it.
Welcome to Film Weekly, Jamie. Lovely to see you.
Thank you very much for having me.
There does seem to be a real swell of young British talent. With you and Nick and Holt and Rob Pattinson, there are very sort of... It's sort of unusual that you get a kind of agglomeration like this. And I do think that the British film industry needs some stars. It's not not a pejorative way. It needs young actors that it can kind of grow with and the audiences can grow with. And you seem to be sort of part... You're going to be part of that generation, whether you like it or not, young man.
Thank you. Well, should I say thanks? Or?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's quite an exciting time for young actors in general. And I think studios now and not only independent movies, but big budget movies and studio films as well are realizing the fact that they maybe don't necessarily need big names to put bums on seats. They can afford to put sort of unknown young actors or actors who have done a few things beforehand into these big films.
But look at Robert Pattinson. He became big because he was in a film.
Exactly. And you look and you look at something like Percy Jackson, The Lightning Thief, and Logan Lerman, who has been around for a while but not many people would have heard of, is the main character in what's going to be a huge series of films. So I think it's quite exciting.
I also think it's a healthy thing that you are not just part of a British film industry, that you can do Hollywood stuff. And you, in particular, in Winter and Wartime, are doing European stuff. which I don't know how you got sort of sucked into that. How did you? What were you doing in a Dutch film?
What are you doing in a Dutch movie? What? Get out! I just finished a small part in Guy Ritchie's Rock and Roller. And my agent called me up and said, well, I've got this really lovely script and I think it'd be really good. And it's an independent European film. And I think you could be very good for it. And I read it and I mean, the story is brilliant. The story is perfect. And Jan Terlouw, who wrote the novel, I mean, it's a very much loved novel in Holland. And so I went over and met the director, Martin Koolhoven, and sort of workshopped with, Martin Lakmeer,
the young Michael,
and Melody Klaver, who plays his sister.
Very attractive older sister, I thought.
Yes, she's lovely. Yes, she's very.
So does your character cool. Clearly think the same?
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Or I think he's more interested in the fact that she's a nurse.
Right. Yes, he needs to get to health, but it helps, doesn't it?
Every little helps. So I went and workshopped it and sort of had my fingers crossed, and I got a call a week later saying, congratulations, you're going to Lithuania. It was lucky for me to get the role. And what was interesting was the fact that my grandfather, originally the Jack, the character I play, who's the pilot, was a pilot in a Spitfire. And then we changed it to him being a navigator in a bomber. And my grandfather in the Second World War was a navigator in a bomber and got shot down.
Where was he shot down?
He was shot down over Germany.
Wow.
And was taken prisoner and taken captive. And he'd written this sort of written it in German, because after he was captured, he sort of, I don't know if he fell in love with the German culture or whatever, but he definitely sort of had an admiration for it. And he wrote this sort of 2-page essay about his experience in German. And only after I shot the film did my grandma let me see it, and she had it translated, and I was able to read it and sort of hear about his experience.
So did you know the story of your grandfather before?
I did,
this,
yes.
But you just hadn't read the essay. Yeah. What did the essay reveal?
It revealed many things. When he was shot down, he ejected, and he was coming down in his parachute and got stuck in some trees.
But like your exactly like your character.
Pretty much like my character. And then apart from in the film, there's a German underneath. And with him, it was wild boar, which he describes in the story as being he was quite scared at that point, and so he was on the run for I think 3 days, desperately trying to make it across to Switzerland or France, I can't quite remember, and then got captured and taken to a prisoner of war camp and tried to escape numerous occasions. I think one was trying to rip a toilet out of a wall and try and get through there.
Oh, that old remember. One.
Yeah, oh, that old
yeah,
number.
See?
Yeah,
they get his number there. Well, I mean, that's an extraordinary kind of mirroring of life. I saw you in Sweeney Todd. I very much enjoyed you in that. I very much enjoyed that film immensely. What else is coming up on the horizon? Are you now part of the Tim Burton gang? Are you in Alice in Wonderland? Are you a small
I'm
rabbit?
Not. I'm not in Alice in Wonderland. Damn. I wish I was. I'm going to cry. I am just about to start. I just finished my work on Harry Potter last week. I'm just doing the last
this one.
Yeah.
Okay. That's sad, because you've come in, they've been doing it for 7 films, and you come in on the last one and get all that, oh, that kind of sadness.
Yeah. Well, they haven't finished yet, so they're still having a great time, so they don't finish for another few months. So I was like, see ya, bye.
Brilliant.
And then I'm about to start work on a Roland Emmerich film called Anonymous, about... William de Vere, who was the Earl of Oxford, who people say has written or could have written Shakespeare's works.
Right, so that's a period film here in the UK?
We're filming it in Berlin.
Right.
Just outside of
with
Berlin.
With Roland Emmerich. He did 2012 or 2012.
Exactly.
He doesn't work on small budgets.
No.
So is this another huge budget with a big meteor coming in at the end to blow up the 16th century Britain?
Well, there is a metaphorical meteor. Yes, there is. I think the piece itself will be probably fairly well received, but there will be diehard Shakespeare fans which will not,
not like it. Introduce the bard.
Yes, people forget that he did do a film. He did a film called The Patriot, which was a period piece.
Then are you in? Have you got your costume sorted
I'm
out
in
for that?
Full garb.
Yeah,
full
excellent.
Garb.
Flowing locks, the lot.
A ruff.
Well, that would be amazing filming for Roland Emmerich. Who else is in that? Because he doesn't do things by halves. He normally has enormous stars in there.
It's Rhys Ifans, Jodie Richardson, David Thewlis, Xavier Samuel,
Will Smith would be sort of out of context, really, but he yes. normally calls on him. But that would be amazing if he did.
Yeah.
But no, he's someone to work with, I think, Roland Emmerich.
I think it'll be fantastic. I think it's going to be really fun.
Well, go enjoy playing the Earl of Oxford.
Thank you.
I very much enjoyed you in Winter and Wartime. Glad to see you've shaved the beard off, though, yeah. and had a wash.
Yes.
Good.
A little.
Congratulations, Jamie Campbell. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Winter in Wartime gets a limited release here in the UK from Friday, the 12th of February. And that is it for this week. If you are a budding filmmaking talent, the Rush's Soho Shorts Film Festival is now open for entries. It's the perfect way to get yourself noticed. To enter, just go to sohoshorts.com. Don't forget, pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. My BAFTA preview piece is in there and all the best film news and reviews. The music featured in this week's podcast is the Danny Elfman soundtrack to The Wolfman. You see, Danny Elfman suggested to me they wanted to go camp, but they didn't. Anyway, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and see you. Oh!